Good day, Internet.
Good day, Internet.
Good day, Internet.
Good day, Internet.
Good day, Jim Briney.
Good day, Internet.
Ah, it's good to have you back. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. We are going to talk pixels and chips. This is going to be a good show.
It is. I'm excited.
Me too.
I am excited.
I'm excited.
Well, then we should just get into it. Let's do it. Here we go. In 3, 2. Daily Tech News Show is made possible by its listeners. Thanks to all of you, including Logan Larson, Mike Akins, and Norm Fizikas. Coming up on DTNS, Google's got new Pixel phones. They're great. They're reasonably priced. Will anyone buy them? I don't know. And Jen Briney from the Congressional Dish is here to tell us what's actually in the CHIPS Act. This is the Daily Tech News for Thursday, October 6th, 2022 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
From Columbus, Ohio, I'm Rob Dunwood.
I'm Roger Chang, the show's producer.
And joining us, host of Congressional Dish, Jen Briney. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for reading the entire CHIPS Act for us.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
No, I know, but that's why we appreciate it all the more. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Pixel phones, but let's start with a few tech things you should know. The quick hits. The Australian government proposed changes to consumer privacy rules that would allow telcos to share government-issued identification documents with banks to better implement enhanced monitoring for data breaches, something that Australians wish would have happened earlier. The data can only be used for preventing and responding to security incidents, fraud, scam activity, or identity theft, and must be destroyed when no longer needed. This comes after the breach at the telco Optus exposed personal information on as many as 10 million accounts. That's a lot of accounts.
A couple of AI stories to tell you about. Alphabet's DeepMind published a paper in the journal Nature detailing AlphaTensor, designed to discover novel, efficient, and probably correct algorithms. So it's an AI that can discover more AI.
Right.
Google also announced its text-to-video systems. One is called Imagine Video, which, similar to Meta's recently shown Make a Video system, uses a short text prompt to generate a 16-frame, 3 frames per second video at 24 by 48 pixel resolution, which is upscaled to 24 frames per second at 720p. Google also showed Finacki, designed to turn longer detailed prompts into videos with 2 minutes, but currently offers less resolution.
All right. Well, we're going from images to videos already. This is a big one. Netflix has agreed with major U.S. theater chains AMC, Regal, and Cinemark to show Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery in their theaters for a limited but exclusive run. This is not just to get award consideration. They could have done a much smaller run for that. 600 theaters, so not all their theaters, but 600 theaters across the United States will get what's going to be billed as a sneak preview run of the movie from November 23rd through November 29th, so the Thanksgiving weekend. Then it'll be out of theaters and unavailable to watch on Netflix until it shows up on the streaming service December 23rd. It's the first time AMC, Regal, or Cinemark have shown anything from Netflix in one of their theaters.
Bloomberg sources say that Twitter and Elon Musk agreed to delay Musk's deposition in the company's lawsuit previously set for Thursday. That's actually today. This indicates the two companies may be close to an acquisition deal that would settle the court case.
I mean, anybody's guess what's actually going to happen, but here's the thing that actually points towards one outcome. So there you go. And Hyundai's joint venture with Aptiva, called Motional, has signed a 10-year deal to provide autonomous vehicles to Uber's ride-hailing and delivery service. So not just Uber, but Uber Eats too. The companies did not announce service areas, but they did say they'd launch in multiple cities in the United States. Motional already works with Lyft to provide autonomous vehicles in Las Vegas, and Uber actually has a separate deal with Nuro for vehicles in California and Texas. All right, Google had an announcement in New York City to announce the details of the Pixel 7, the 7 Pro, and the Pixel Watch. They teased all these during Google I.O. back in May. You probably remember that. But now we have the details, and all three Pixels are available to order now, shipping October 13th.
Let's start with features that are available in both the Pixel 7 and 7 Pro. They both run on the new Google Design Tensor G2 chip, have IP68 dust and waterproof protection, and claim to get 24 hours on a single charge, up to 72 hours when the battery saver kicks in. The Pixels are capable of Qi wireless charging, USB-C fast charging, and can charge other devices.
Now, some of the features coming to the phone include cough and snore detection while you're sleeping. Stays on device. They're not going to send it to the cloud. Google previously launched Real Tone on the Pixel for more accurate skin tone in photos, and now is going to offer Guided Frame, which helps people with low vision frame up a shot using haptics and audio guidance, like telling you raise it up, lower it down. There's also Cinematic Blur, which some people might just call bokeh, Photo Unblur, Face Unblur, and Google Assistant has some Pixel-specific features, like you can now tell the Pixel, silence, if you want it to stop ringing, which will be fun to shout. And it will transcribe your voice messages, something that iPhone users have enjoyed. It's going to be able to do that. And it can label the different speakers in the Recorder app if you're like recording a meeting or something like that.
So yeah, the recording is really interesting to me. And then also, will it kick me if I'm snoring like my wife?
They need some stronger haptics for that. Yeah,
I'm just wondering. But the Pixels both come with an underscreen fingerprint sensor and face unlock. Though face unlock is not available for everything, since the fingerprint is still considered more secure on the Pixel. The Pixels both ship with Google One's VPN built in at no additional cost, though it's not available in all countries. And some systems won't actually send data through the VPN. You also get 5 years of security updates on both the Pixel 7 and 7 Pro.
Okay, so that's what's in both phones, but let's tell you the differences. The Pixel 7 has a 6.3-inch 1080 by 2400 screen, up to 90 hertz variable refresh rate. Comes with 8 gigs of RAM. You can get it in either 128 or 256 gigs of storage. Has a rear 50-megapixel camera and the same front-facing main and ultra-wide sensors as the Pro. It doesn't have a telephoto lens. The Pro does. The Pixel 7 will start at an affordable $599.
The Pixel 7 Pro has a 6.7-inch 1140 by 3120 display with up to 120 hertz variable refresh rate. It has polished aluminum frame and adds a 48-megapixel telephoto lens to the rear camera that can do up to 5x optical zoom or 30x digital. It can also macro focus at close as 3 centimeters. It has 12 gigs of RAM and adds a 512 gigabyte storage option. The Pixel 7 Pro starts at $899.
So these prices, relative to others with similar specs on the marketplace, are pretty good. The builds look great. Essentially, if you're paying for the Pro, you're paying for the bigger screen, the better camera, and maybe some increased storage options and better RAM and such. What do you, as an Android user, think about these, Rob? Are you tempted to switch to the Pixel?
So it is it's not so much the hardware. I have been Team Samsung since I think the Galaxy S3. So I just like Samsung's hardware, but the software additions, the voice transcription that this phone can do is second to none. I mean, you literally talk to it and it figures out what you're saying and types it out for you. I mean, which you would think all of transcribing does, but it's just better. The ability for you to make a phone call, or someone to call you, and then it basically answers, screens them, does all kind of stuff. I would actually pay for that service, that it is so good for people who I know who have Pixels. So the software things that Google is doing on this phone are really interesting to me. The hardware, I still kind of like just the look and polish that you get with all that glass on the Samsung devices. But the hard, like I said, the software is really making me perk my eyes up and say, I might have to try this out.
I've used that that automatic Google Assistant thing where it can talk to someone for you and you're just tapping the stuff. And in fact, they've got some improvements here where they say if it's a commonly called number, it'll start sharing what the options are. It won't wait to hear the options. But I always wonder if I'm being as bad as I feel when I have to deal with a phone tree, an automated phone tree. But I guess the turnabout is fair play, right? Jen, as an iPhone user, have we swayed you at all with these Pixel stats? Does this bring any interest to your phone life?
So the one thing that made me curious is the speech to text, because I'm huge on that. You can see I'm wearing giant glasses because I strain my eyes a lot with what I do. So I'm using speech to text, and I do find myself editing a lot when I'm using it to text people, which kind of defeats the purpose of not looking at my phone. So knowing that that's really good was the one thing that made me go like, but the rest of it, I don't know. For me to give up and have to relearn a whole system, I'm definitely in the Apple net. They've captured me completely. So it would have to be something kind of extraordinary, because once I switch the phone, then I feel like my Apple computer doesn't talk to it as well. I would have to go all in on the Google stuff. I'm just not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the problem for a lot of these Android makers, and Google's no exception. Even though they make the operating system, it's hard to break people out of their ecosystems. We just heard it from two different perspectives. We heard Jen talking about it from the iOS perspective, and Rob, you were just basically saying like, well, I'm kind of liking my Samsung life, you know.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know that this is a problem for Google, but it's always been this way. They allow anyone to make Android devices. Anybody can make them. So for years, other manufacturers have made better Android devices than Google itself was making. So you now have people who are kind of locked in. So clearly it is not as much of an ecosystem thing for me. It is just, I like the big giant phone with the pen that I use more so than being able to transcribe something on my phone. So I'm not saying that I'm not interested in the Pixel. It's just, I don't know that there's enough there yet to make me switch over from what I'm currently using.
It just sounds real familiar to me to hear a bunch of people talk about how good a phone is that is not going to sell. It happened to HTC. It happened to LG. It's currently true for Sony. They sell well in Japan, but outside of Japan, almost no one knows about the Xperia phones, and they're great phones. So I look at this and I'm like, Google only reports $6.55 billion in other revenue. That's not even just their hardware. That's all their hardware plus Google Play. Compare right. $6.55 billion to the $50.5 billion Apple makes on iPhone. Samsung's making billions off the Galaxy line. I'm not saying these are bad phones. I just don't know where this goes for Google, unless they go a Microsoft route and say, it's not the sales numbers that matter. It's us showing off the capabilities. We're the showcase phone for Android.
And if they do that, they have to start allowing some of these Pixel-only features to move to additional Android devices. Because I'll be flat out honest with you. I'm probably more apt to move to iPhone than I am to move to Pixel. Because, like, what's the point? I want to get, transcription. That is an awesome, awesome thing. But I don't know if it's enough to just change everything. If I want to change everything, I might as well just change to a completely different platform. That's just me, though.
And if they are using it as a showcase and those features do move to Samsung phones, let's say, then you're going to look at it and think, well, can I just wait? Can I just wait until it shows up on Samsung? Like, you know, it takes away a little of the impetus to move it. So I'm not even sure what Google's up to here. Except making very nice phones at a very good price. So
no, they are really good phones. If you are coming from a mid-tier or lower end Android device and you want to get into a premium device, these things are very, very well priced. I think that Samsung Apple, they definitely figured out back in 2020, you can't charge people $1,300, $1,400 for a phone. They'll just wait until that phone breaks before they shell out that kind of money. So the phones have definitely gotten less expensive over the last couple of years. And the Pixel really has never been super expensive. So that's always a good thing. But these are very, very, very good phones for that price range. So like, I definitely recommend them if you're on like a mid-tier phone and you're just trying to move to get, the best of Android. You're probably not going to do better on Android than you will do with a Pixel.
Maybe that's their best bet. Maybe that's their path, is to say, look, compare it to a Galaxy A, not a Galaxy S, a Galaxy A, and we're amazing. If you're stepping up, you don't have to step up to $1,400. You don't have to get a Fold. Step up to a Pixel. You don't have to spend that much more money than what you're spending already. Maybe that'll work for them.
Yeah. And we didn't even talk about this, but the camera on the Pixel, Pretty much since the Pixel has been out, we have always talked about, man, those pictures look great.
Yeah, they do.
You know, with what they're doing with this new processor. Last year, they came out with the Real Tone that was a big deal. They're adding, you know, the new stuff for, you know, people who are visually impaired, which is kind of awesome. I mean, that is not an insignificant thing that they're doing. So when you, like I said, when you look at the software on this, you're getting the best of Android on this phone. You're getting what iOS is to the iPhone on a Google device. It's just that they're so far behind with, you know, just now catching up to where hardware is even comparable to their, you know, to their, you know, to their competition, that, like I said, I'm all in on this platform, on this operating system. I just don't know that I'm willing to give my pen up I only use once every 3 or 4 months.
Make one with a pen, for goodness sake, you'll get robbed. Even making their own chips, that Tensor chip that Google designed. It's a good chip. Finally, we should mention the Pixel tablet got another look. That's not coming out until 2023, so we didn't get specs and shipping, but Google said that the coating, they compared the coating to a La Crusette Dutch oven. I like my La Crusette. I guess that's nice. And there's also going to be a docking station, so you can use the tablet like you would a Nest Hub smart display when you're not using it as a tablet.
That really looks cool, but would you bet money they're not going to cancel it?
Oh, man. It's not even out yet, Rob. Give them a second before you lose faith.
I don't trust them. I just don't trust them.
What do you want to hear us talk about on the show? One way to let us know is our subreddit. Submit stories and vote on them at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. Third time's a charm. I shouldn't have pressed it so early. The president of the United States went to Poughkeepsie, New York on Thursday to talk about IBM's plans to spend $20 billion there over the next decade on chip making and quantum computing. The president traveled to Ohio last month for Intel's $20 billion chip plant promise. And Rob, you can see it from your window, right? You said it's under construction.
Yeah, I could see it from my yard.
Yeah. Tuesday, Micron promised $100 billion to spend over the next two decades to build chip plants in New York. One wonders if this might upset trading partners like, I don't know, Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. And the answer is yeah, probably. So the United States has created the Chip4 Alliance to ensure a stable supply chain and keep advanced chip making technology out of the hands of mainland China. Taiwan's Deputy Economic Affairs Minister Chen Chunyi said the manufacturing equipment comes primarily from the U.S. and Europe. The raw materials come from Japan and manufacturing technology from Taiwan and Korea. So this requires collaboration to form a very resilient supply chain. Of course, all of this is following the passage this summer of the U.S. Chips and Science Act of 2022, aka the CHIPS Act. Jen Briney is possibly the only person on earth to have read the entire CHIPS Act. So we wanted to get her to explain what's actually in there. Jen, thank you. What's actually in there?
Well, the big story here is $50 billion for the industry. It's our tax money that is going to be funneled through the Department of Commerce, and it's going to go to these corporations. I would imagine IBM would get a piece of it, but we don't know exactly who. The reason I think IBM is on the list is because they have been the sole source foundry for the Department of Defense for quite a while. And there is $2 billion specifically for the Department of Defense for microchip industry things.
Development, yeah.
So there's $50 billion there for that. And then there's a few billion more for research and development and education. So the research and development, it was quite clear for me that the idea is that our tax money will pay to essentially invent new tech that will be handed to the private sector. And so while there's billions appropriated, there are tens of billions of dollars authorized. So they would have to, in a future law, actually give out the money, but the permission slip has already been granted. So while this bill is valued at about, and it depends on who you ask, but it's like $60 billion-ish, the amount that has been appropriated for this industry is far more, or authorized, I should say, is far more than that. So it's basically like $50 billion now for the industry, education and inventions, likely in the future if the money is actually appropriated in future laws.
Yeah. I've seen numbers around $170 billion for the stuff outside of just the $50 billion, right? That could go. How much in this act is about other tech? It's called the CHIPS Act, but it seems like a lot of it is not really about chip making itself.
So funding-wise, the vast majority of it is actually for the chips, because out of the stuff that is appropriated, $50 billion, and actually more than that, if you include the Defense Department and the State Department, all the money they get, that's specifically for chips. Mm. But most of the law itself, like the pages of it, was authorizing these other programs and doing a lot of different kinds of like educational programs that will flow money from the federal government to state and local governments, nonprofits, universities, and the private sector. And what I found really interesting is that that money, which is authorized, which there is a difference. You authorize stuff and then the money is actually appropriated. They've done the first step. But the decision-making on that, they've created a lot of boards to actually hand out the money, and the private sector has gotten a huge role in the seats on those boards. So really, industry has been given permission in certain ways to be directing where this research and development and education funding will eventually go. But this particular law, the money that's actually provided, most of it is for semiconductors.
That's interesting. So if I have this right, the $52 billion number you see thrown around is money that that is authorized. That's going to be spent. The $170
billion...
Appropriated. Got it.
Yes.
The $170 billion is like, yeah, maybe, you know, we could set up a committee and they could go up to that amount, or it's a little mushier.
Yes, because there's two parts of government funding. So they authorize stuff first. So actually, this $50+ billion that's going to the semiconductor industry was actually authorized years ago in a defense authorization. So the permission was already given.
Huh.
The second half of this law, where, like I said, there's tens of billions of dollars authorized, but there's going to have to be a future law that actually hands out that money. Now, we are in a government funding cycle where we're funding our government improperly every year. There's supposed to be 12 separate bills that do this. They're funding it all at once. And that is set to happen on December 16th. And when you have these massive government funding laws right before the holidays that no one reads, that's when a lot of this stuff can get appropriated, because the price tag is so huge that it's not as obvious. So I think if they were to appropriate $170 billion in this CHIPS law, that would have been a much bigger scandal than the $50 billion they actually did. And then the rest of the stuff they can kind of, you know,
over
push
time
out later. Mm. Yeah, or the stuff that they never intended to appropriate to begin with, they can make it look like they're going to, but like, whoopsie, we never funded it, so
yeah,
it doesn't actually exist.
There's a difference between saying, I'll write a check, and writing the check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Kind of feels like, you know, back, you remember the old Oprah show when like, you get a car, you get a car. It's like, you get a billion, you get a billion, you get a billion. So it's like, you know, they've said, we will write this check for this money, but we still have to pass a law to determine who ultimately is going to get it.
Yeah.
And that's just so how the government operates. It just, it's very slow moving.
Well, this one was a big fat check to the semiconductor industry. Yeah. Like, it's a done deal for the $50 billion.
And I'll be honest, it certainly seems to have gotten the companies excited, so it's obviously had an effect. You see the president going to Ohio, you see him going to New York. Mm-hmm. But when I look at the numbers, as huge as $52 billion sounds to me personally, when I look at the fact that it's $20 billion to spend on chip making for IBM, $20 billion for Intel, and Intel has talked about spending $100 billion in Arizona, Micron spending $100 billion, and knowing that that $52 billion has to get split up among multiple companies over 5 years, I don't know how much difference it really makes. I mean, it seems like it's spending a lot of money for us, and yet was it really even that much money? Was it necessary to get them to move their companies, or were they going to move it anyway?
Well, I have my doubts that they were going to move it anyway, because when they got the permission to labor shop around the world, in the 1990s, they did. So the percentage of the industry that is controlled by so-called U.S. companies, although they're multinationals, but the so-called U.S. companies have always controlled between 40 and 50% of the market. What's changed, though, is the actual production of the chips. We now only produce 11% because these companies went and built their foundries in places where they can pay people damn near nothing to make them. So I do think that giving them tax money and saying you can only spend this here, because the vast majority of it, says in clear language, this has to be spent building foundries inside the United States. You can't build foundries or even upgrade the ones you have overseas. By requiring that, then it makes them go like, okay, well, if we're going to get some of this money, we're going to invest somewhere and it has to be here. That is why I think they're choosing to do it here, because they're going to have to pay at least a minimum wage to the people working here. And they don't want to do that. That's not instinctual. So I do think that it's having the intended effect.
So it's enough to entice them to do it. And it's worth doing for the government because it locks them into keeping it here. That makes sense to me. The other question I have about this, and this is less about what's actually in the CHIPS Act, but the idea that we're going to make the chips on U.S. soil, I think to a lot of people sounds like, oh, so then they're done. And the fact of the matter is, chip fabrication is just one part of the process. There's design, there's packaging, there's testing, there's assembly. And especially when you're talking about packaging and assembly, we're not moving those parts of the process over here. So these chips that we're making in the U.S. are still going to go on a boat somewhere else to get packaged and assembled.
Yes, they are. Hence, our globalized system has some problems. And that was always their justification for moving the foundries overseas like that, that they would have the production at least close to one another. So if you had like the chips being made in Taiwan and then the testing being done in Korea, it was all in the same neighborhood. And so now there is going to be more international shipping going back and forth. And nothing in this chips law said you had to do any of that other stuff here in the States. So I looked at this law and saw it as being quite incomplete, and that is a good point. That is one of the things that they left out, along with any taxpayer return on investment, which if you listen to my episode, I rant and rave about that. We were required to, like, we don't get any profit sharing. We don't get any cut of the companies, like nothing. It's just we give them the money and do what
you theoretically make tax revenue off of it.
Theoretically, sure.
Theoretically, yeah. So, yeah, go ahead, Rob.
I just want to say, being here in Columbus, you hear about what Intel is doing. And the, you know, the big news all the time is the taxpayers get nothing from this. It's like, oh, well, people are going to have more jobs and therefore they'll pay more income tax, they'll pay more property tax, because it's not just a foundry. I mean, there are homes, there are companies that are going to support Intel. All of this stuff is being built, and that's just what they keep, keep throwing out. But it's kind of like, well, that's always the case. People who work always pay taxes. Companies who have employees always pay taxes. So how is that truly benefiting the taxpayers here in Ohio for subsidizing this massive development that they're about to do?
I agree completely. I came to the same conclusion, and there was nothing in the law that requires them to stay 20 years from now. So, I mean, just look at what happened to Detroit when they had an industry and then the industry pulled out and now the whole town was, you know, in trouble. So there were not anywhere near the number of protections for the taxpayers, and pretty much close to zero, actually. When I say nowhere near, I'm trying to think of any. And that was probably the most upsetting thing for me. I do believe in it being important to have a industry, manufacturing industry here in the United States for self-sufficiency. There's a lot of good reasons for it, but we should get a return on that investment. And I mean an actual financial return. And there was nothing like that required. So yeah, I did feel the rage bubbles as I was reading it because of that.
I think if there are some good things in this act, one of the good things is that it is certainly helping us diversify the supply chain. One of the problems with the supply chain that became very apparent during COVID was, with chips, there were so many others, but just with chips, there were Taiwanese companies with all of their fabs in China. And suddenly there was a backlog getting things out of China. And so having a diversified system, in my mind, where you have some of every bit of the process, fabrication, packaging, et cetera, some of it in Taiwan, some of it in Vietnam, some of it in Korea, Japan, India, Brazil, and the United States, and I'll just leave it there, but other places as well, Germany, the Netherlands, et cetera. That's good. Make it so that if one part suffers a breakdown, it doesn't bring the entire system to a halt. And I think that's a positive development out of that.
I agree. And especially because so much of it was concentrated in Taiwan. Taiwan's becoming a flashpoint for war things. I mean, there is a not zero chance that China could invade Taiwan. And the foundries are on the coast that faces China. So one of the reasons that there was urgency on this is that if there is a war, those foundries could either be captured by China or they could be destroyed. And so there is this urgency to prepare for that possibility and to move this production so that the supply chain isn't so concentrated in this one location.
Not to mention a lot of those Taiwanese companies have foundries in mainland China. As relations break down, what would have been unthinkable 10 years ago, nationalization of a plant and taking it away, feels like something that's not necessarily impossible. So you want to move things around for that reason too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Jen, thank you so much again for going through all the hard work of reading these bills and sharing your expertise. If you haven't listened to the episode on the CHIPS Act, a congressional dish, definitely go do that. But this is even one of the less interesting bills that you cover. Tell folks about some of the other stuff you do.
Well, yeah, I read bills and laws, but I also watch a lot of hearings. And so even the hearings give me information. Like, there was one about pet collars that I watched recently. Like, there are pet collars, the number one on the market, the Seresto flea and tick collars, that are poisoning pets. And they're doing nothing about it. So it's Congress is my window to the world, and I just dig for these stories. So I'm going to be working on the Inflation Reduction Act because, you know, that's the biggest thing the Democrats did. But yeah, I'm fascinated by what goes on in the halls of Congress. And so if you want to hear some stories that are not being reported and some details on bills and laws, Congressional Dish is a pretty good place to go.
I agree. Congressionaldish.com. You don't even have to agree with Jen. I don't always agree with Jen, but I always value your detail. I always value your perspective and the work you put in and the information you bring me. It's incredible. So go check that out, folks. Congressionaldish.com. And as a bonus, if you just like hearing Jen talk, she sat down and talked about disaster with me on A Word with Tom Merritt. We had a great time talking about prepping, disaster movies, games she plays with her husband to prepare for disasters. So go check that out at awordpodcast.com as well. awordpodcast.com and congressionaldish.com. Of course, before we go, Rob, what you got going on these days?
Not a whole lot, just podcasting and talking about tech. So you can check me out pretty much everywhere around the web at Rob Dunwood, and also head over to thetechjohn.com. That is like my new baby. It's just over a year old now, and we are having so much fun talking about the weekly tech that comes up, but talking about it from a, let's say, a blacker perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks to our brand new boss, Dr. Mr. Esquire. First of all, great username. Second of all, thank you for supporting us. Third of all, just like Dr. Mr. Esquire, you could be the star of the show tomorrow if you start backing us at patreon.com/DTNS. Patrons, stick around. We're going to talk more about all of this stuff on Good Day Internet. You can also catch the show live Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 2000 UTC. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. Back tomorrow, talking about the features you'll want in your next TV with Robert Herron, and Len Peralta will be here too. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Jen.
That was very fun. I didn't know you were a Diamond Clubber.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm founding member. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Very cool.
When I got fired... had started Daily Tech News Show, Justin and Brian and I cooked up the idea for a community. And then, of course, because Brian and Justin are brilliant, they were the ones who like floated the idea out there, and the community just assembled itself around it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm fascinated how wide Justin's web is in podcasting and all of this. It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
We're everywhere.
Well, and you have one of the old comedy film nerds coming on, I heard you mention.
Yeah.
And I'm friends with them, Graham and Chris, the other comedy film nerd. I met them when I first moved to Los Angeles. So when I heard that, I was like, oh, cool. Graham's going to be on. That's great.
Yeah. I've been friends with Graham for years because he was in charge, or he wasn't in charge. He was one of the co-owners of LA Podfest. And I loved that festival. And then things happened, but we've stayed friends for a very long time.
I have to reach out to Graham. I haven't talked to him in a while, but yeah, I did LA Podfest a couple of years, I think.
Really? Then I was there.
I probably walked right past you and didn't even know it.
Probably, because I wasn't like performing or anything. I was just one of the dorky fans, like checking out a bunch of new shows. And
And I would come in and do Daily Tech News Show and then bolt, like, because I was so busy with stuff. So I didn't even get to hang around much.
Oh, that's a shame. That festival, they always had them in the most fabulous hotels.
I know.
And it was great. I had so much fun.
Yeah. It's a small podcasting world out there.
It is. With good people, though.
Yeah, absolutely. You should check out SMR Podcast.
SMR, what does that stand for?
So this was a horribly named show. We named it after the company, Simple Mobile.
Okay.
Telephone company back in the day. And it was Simple Mobile Review. But we don't even refer to that. That was, we started that show, I want to say 2008. And it's just been SMR, you know, ever since, because we just generally, it's usually a tech show, but we kind of just talk about and opine about whatever's on our mind.
2008. Wow. You are like one of the OGs in podcasting.
People keep telling me that. I don't know if I believe it.
Well, I think the VP of Libsyn started in like 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Curry was around that same time. I mean, if you're in the first 3 years, I think you're one of the first.
Because I started in 2005, but whenever someone talks about how long I've been doing it, I'm always can name three people who've been doing it longer, like Adam, for instance.
Yeah, like you're definitely one of the first.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Brian Ibbitt.
Brian Ibbitt's been doing Coverville since 2004. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to have your level of tech knowledge to do it back then.
It was wild. I was talking about this somewhere the other day. I don't remember where, but the first show that I did was called Buzz Out Loud. It was when I worked for CNET. It was me and Molly Wood, and we would just email a list of links to each other and then just sit down and talk. No prep. like we didn't even meet in the first year to talk about them. We just looked at the email. We're like, yeah, okay, that looked good. It was just, you know, nobody'd done it before. So we were flying by the seat of our pants.
Yeah.
That's definitely how SMR started. And it's still like that today. Yeah, we don't necessarily come with notes. What I do notice, we talked about this a little bit in the pre-show today, is all the equipment that it took to do a live stream. Because we started off live streaming right with our, I think, episode 2 or 3 was when we actually started live streaming. And just all the different things that we had to use to make that happen. And now you literally just log into a website and press play.
Mm-hmm.
So much easier today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to have a spiel for like how to start a podcast, which actually I think technically would still work, but you don't need to do it. just go to Anchor or Acast or, you know.
Yeah.
It would, Tom, because I just started another podcast.
Did you still do it? Yeah.
That's how we got Fulcrum Feed started. It was exactly that same method.
Ah, the old ways are best.
They work and they're free. So
it took me about a month to take a bunch of notes from Daniel Day Lewis. He was my teacher. I took a bunch of notes from his Audacity to Podcast.
Uh-huh.
And then I did it, but I had to submit my show to all the different locations. Oh, yeah. And anytime, Stitcher was much bigger back in 2012, remember? And they always did everything differently. So if I had to change my show, I had to like go specifically to Stitcher. Just the production on the back end was so much harder. And now Libsyn just does everything for us. And these new people that can start a podcast in 5 minutes. And I'm like, you don't know what it was like.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. But it's good.
It was good education for me though. Like, yeah. I'm glad I had to do it, because now when something goes wrong, I have the technology. I don't think I would if I didn't have to go through that whole exercise.
No, that's a good point. It makes a difference. I feel like I'm losing some skills with new things because they are handled by services, you know, just because when I started doing websites and when I started doing podcasting later than that, like, you had to learn how it all worked yourself. At the same time, I don't know that I have the patience to learn all that stuff anymore. It was one thing to do it when I was in my 20s. It just gets harder as you get older, right?
Yeah, I took a whole WordPress class and got the website up and running and then forgot everything immediately. I hated it so much. So, yeah. It's interesting because we do this. Well, I mean, you guys are a little different because you're Daily Tech News, so this might not be as applicable to you, but I have stuff to say. I'm talking about Congress. So the tech is the necessary evil that I have to learn to get it done. I don't enjoy it. I don't like knowing any of this. And so it's like pure torture to learn the new programs. And when Apple changes things, it makes me insane. And
No, so me too.
Really? Do you guys get annoyed with learning new tech?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Because there's tech you want to learn because it's fun, and then there's tech you have to learn because they change something. And those are two entirely different things.
Yep. Okay. That makes me feel less bad then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I am deep into tech. I will sit and watch video after video. Oh, that's cool how he actually did this. And I like how he, you know, that his piece of code was 32 lines less than mine. Let me go figure out how he's doing it better with a little code. I like geeking out on that. But then there's some things, it's like, do I really want to apply this update? What's it going to do? Mm-hmm. Nothing that I care about. How long can I run without actually doing the update? There was a time when there was something new, I was on that bleeding edge. And as soon as something from Microsoft came out, I was updating it. And now it's like, it's probably going to make me safer. So it's kind of like, you know, what do you put your time to? Because, you know, doing all those little things, they do take a chunk of your time.
Yeah. Anytime I see an Apple update, I'm like, what did you change? What are you going to move and make it hard for me to do the stuff that I already know how to do? Yeah. I'm one of those people that waits as long as possible. I have a question for you guys. Are you the type of people that when something new comes out, you've ever waited overnight outside of like a Best Buy? Like, are you the campers for tech? And what was the tech?
Not usually. When people first started doing that, like with the first iPhone, I had to go interview people for that. So I was like, I don't want to be there. I have to be there, and I don't even get to be in line. So I was kind of resentful about that. But I think I did get in line for one. Oh yeah. No, I did. I got in line for an iPhone in 2011, to be in line and buy it and cover it. And I almost got kicked out by mall security because it was in a mall and they saw me live streaming. I had a laptop and I was live streaming and they're like, you can't do that. And so I was like, why? And they're like, it's a mall, private property. We're not, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I just,
dumb.
Yeah, I shut it off.
I sat outside a Verizon store for the iPhone 6.
Okay.
I got there at noon, and then it was the Thursday before they went on sale on Friday. So I got there at noon and was there the entire time. I was first person in line. And the first half hour was there, everybody told me I was crazy for being there so early. And within the first hour that I was there, there were like 10 other people in line behind me. And then, of course, the news came out, and this is one of those fun stories where the news came out as my wife had come up and brought me some dinner, and I had left and gone across the parking lot to the Olive Garden to use the restroom, came back, and the news was leaving. Like, they wanted to interview the first person in line, and I wasn't there for it.
Oh.
And my wife was like, no, I'm not doing this. So they interviewed the second person in line because I was at the bathroom. So yeah.
What was it about the six that made you be like, I need to be number one in line?
Honestly, I had the day off. Like, I was like, I'm going to do this eventually, and I've got Thursday and Friday off because I'm working this weekend, so I might as well do it now. So I just went and did it. And
I think a lot of people do it because of the fun of being in line, which I know sounds crazy, but like talking to the other people, feeling the excitement, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah. I waited. I wouldn't do it again, but I'm glad I did it.
I waited in line for Twilight because my wife and her friends really wanted to go. I was getting off work right when they would need someone to get in line. It was before you could do advanced tickets on Fandango, so you had to get in line to get the tickets. And I was like, yeah, I'll go. I just want to soak up the vibe. I just want to see what the people in line are talking about and do it. It was super fun. I just held their place until they got there.
It's basically tailgating.
Right?
Yeah.
It really is exactly that.
Yeah, somebody brought a cooler with beers and was handing them out, and it was exactly like tailgating.
Yeah, sounds fun.
Oh, Darganon wants to know if I meant the movie or the time of day. I did mean the movie. I wasn't just waiting for the sun to go down.
I kind of did that for the last Twilight movie. My wife was trying to get tickets. She could not get tickets to save her life, and I had bought tickets for herself and me. And for her and our daughters in a separate, like the next day, so that my wife and I could go on release night and watch it together. And I managed to sneak it away because I had the ticket, the Fandango ticket on my phone. It was the first time I ever used a wallet pass on my phone. And so it was kind of special for me. And then, of course, she wanted to watch the movie and we got in there and she started watching it, and she's over there crying because she read the book but didn't realize she'd forgotten what happened in the book. So she's freaking out with everybody else in the audience. And then when the big reveal happens, I'm like the only person in there just laughing because, having read the book, I knew what was going on. So,
I never made it through the Twilight series. I saw the first one and I just couldn't get into it at all. I never made it that far.
Did you ever wait in line for a thing?
I did, and I can't say that I was like the ringleader on this, but we did see, I think it was the first and second Lord of the Rings. There's a giant movie theater in Newport Beach, and we wanted to see it there at midnight. And so, it was because of our guys, like in our friend group, they wanted to go. So me and my friend Steph were like, yeah, we'll go with the boys, fine. And we show up and everyone there is dressed up. Like, we didn't know what the Lord of the Rings was. And it was just, was a psycho scene. And then we got into the movie. I think we were out there for like 6 hours in the line. So we finally get into the movie and people are throwing toilet paper. It was a party in there. And then the lights go off.
Traditional elven practice of throwing toilet paper.
Yeah, it was quite the scene. And then the minute the lights went off, it was silent. Like everyone was dead serious about the movie. And so, it was fun to see people that into a piece of art. Mm-hmm. I really loved doing it.
Now that you say that, it reminds me that when my wife and I were first in our first couple of years together, we went and got in line for Attack of the Clones.
Same vibe. People dress up for that for sure.
Yep, absolutely. Lots of stormtroopers.
I did get in line early for the new trilogy, the latest trilogy. Mm. For the first one, I was in Osan, Korea, and we only had the base theater that was showing it. So I went early, about 6 hours early, and got my ticket. But I got a ticket for that one and the following show because the second showing was in 3D. And when I got in, I got the very center seat in the theater and just stayed there. And then, of course, the crew came to clean up and try to kick everybody out. And I was like, got my glasses and I got my ticket. I'm staying here. So I sat in the same seat for both the first two showings.
Cool.
That was a good show.
I didn't wait in line for this, but my sister, when Black Panther came out, I don't know if I can technically say she waited in line because they actually rented the theater out. So they had it, but everyone basically got dressed up. Like she was dressed up in this immaculate, African, like kente cloth, like dress that was just like, she looked like she was going to like a black tie event. A guy that I know who actually went to it, he ordered one of those African, lion chassis. If you think back to Coming to America, what James Earl Jones used to wear.
Right.
I mean, clearly it's fake, but he ordered one of those and he's literally dressed up like the king of, Zamunda, going to this. So, she's got a bunch of pictures from that. And it was just really cool because they made it an event to where we're all going to go watch this movie, but we're going to dress up like we're from Wakanda or Zamunda or something like that. So I've always thought that was cool. But I'm not a line stand. I stood in line for the original iPhone. That is the first and the last time. that okay. I've ever done that.
The original iPhone, that one I can understand. To get the very first one, that makes sense to me. Yeah. Just the first of anything that, I mean, the iPhone changed the world. So the fact that you stood in line to be one of the very first people to own it, that's awesome.
You know,
do you still
funny?
Have it?
I was one of the first people to return it.
Really?
So the reason I stood in line is I used to run a BlackBerry enthusiast website. So I had been talking about the iPhone coming out even before Apple officially announced it. So once they announced it, it was, even though I was a BlackBerry website, there was a section that was just about, you know, iPhones. In fact, we called it iPhone Insider. And it was, I need to go get this so I can talk about it for my, for the people who are following me. But I am a 6'4.5" defensive tackle. I've got enormous hands. I was so used to using my thumbs to type on the BlackBerry. When I went to the iPhone, if you remember, the iPhone was a very, very, very small phone. So trying to type on it, I couldn't use my thumbs because my hands were too big to hold it comfortably. So I had to, hunt and peck. And you couldn't, at the time, people who are honest will say that the original iPhone wasn't all that. It was like, it was not till the 3GS and then the 4 came out.
Didn't even have apps.
When it started, right?
Yeah, I mean, it had before built it started making apps, those so that was it.
So I'm like, okay, but there's no apps. I'm comparing it to, what the BlackBerry was. And it's like, I'm not keeping this. I can't believe I stood in line for this. And then lo and behold, it is now, the most dominant computer on earth at this point.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the Apple ecosystem?
So I used to have, I started off, like my first laptop was a PowerBook 520C. So I started off in the Mac world. And it was, for me, I moved to PC simply because this cost $1,700 and this cost $700 and does more. Back in the day, that's what it was for me. So I don't mind. I have Apple devices. It's just that, I love iPads. It's just that the iPhone for me, and I actually really like the iPhone now. It's just that because I didn't start using it and I got so into what I could do with Android, it just never became the paramount thing for me. I've gotten them over the time. I actually have the 14 Pro now. And it's like, this is really nice. I could absolutely use it as my primary driver. But like you were saying, I've got to change so many things about the way I do things now. It's just not necessarily worth it to me, to have a phone that may be a little bit better than the one that I'm currently rocking.
Yeah, that's funny. It's kind of like whatever we start with, we stick with.
Yeah.
Because I think if I had started with Androids and PCs, then I probably would have stayed because the same reason. I don't want to change my work process.
You get used to it.
I started with Android and switched to iPhone. I went from the Droid X, the Motorola Droid X.
People like Amos who start with one and switch.
Yeah, and went to the
that's
iPhone
a lot of them.
4S, yeah. But I did it because of tech. I was the one that was troubleshooting all the family's phones and stuff like that. And it was just easier if we all had the same phone. So switched over.
That's true.
And got everyone else to switch over, so it was easier for me to do the tech troubleshooting. And my cousin Brian stayed with Android and is still on Android now. So anytime someone in the family has an Android phone, he's the tech support for Android side, and I'm the tech support for the Apple side.
By the way, the Musk lawyers have filed, apparently, within the past couple of hours, it's just coming out, they have filed to request formally a stay of the trial, which makes sense, right? They're like, we just need to get the financing together and it's all going to work out. But apparently they wrote in the filing, Twitter will not take yes for an answer. So they're still being just like that about the whole thing.
Elon still being Elon.
Yeah. Or his lawyers are being Elon-ish on his behalf, certainly.
And this is a first edition?
Look at you.
Generation iPod Touch.
Nice. Oh. Yeah, and that's the size of the first iPhone, which is
it was
tiny.
It was a little bit thicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My
thumb is.
Yeah, they were so small.
Yeah.
I mean, Amos has big thumbs, but they're not that big. Come on.
What's that, Rob?
So which one is that, Rob?
Oh, is that BlackBerry?
This is the BlackBerry 9930.
Oh, and I had one of those.
Yeah, I keep this thing powered up. Not powered up, but, charged up. It's ready to go. I could turn it on, and it's working now, because if we ever go back, I'm good. If we ever go back, I'm good.
I really like that prep. Phone. The only problem was that its web performance was so much lacking compared to an iPhone or Android phone.
Oh yeah, it was. There's the BlackBerry movie that's coming out. So I'm keeping all these BlackBerries that I have that are pretty much new in the box, just in case they, you know, whoever's making this movie, if they need to call me up, if they need something, they need me to get some B-roll for them, I'm good. Yeah. Because I probably have 10 or 12 functioning BlackBerries.
The BlackBerry Museum.
I have
a BlackBerry Storm that I picked up before I got my Android, and it's the second revision, the second hardware revision. Mm-hmm. I had the original from release day, and then I dropped it, broke the screen, got a replacement. They ended up replacing it with a brand new one, which was the second revision of the hardware. So it's a little quicker. The click is a little more, you know, more clicky. It's not as soft as the original ones were. And about a month later, I switched to Android and put it in a box. So it's basically brand new in my closet back here.
You going to donate it to the BlackBerry Museum?
I'll give the BlackBerry Museum a commission, you know, a finder's fee if they need to call me for the BlackBerry Storm B-roll.
I missed the whole BlackBerry boat. I was too poor to afford one, so I had disposable phones. Too many people thought I was a drug dealer. And then I finally got one, I think, in like 2011.
Occupational hazard.
It was late. Yeah.
Real quickly, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask Amos, who's in Alaska, about Fat Bear Week. Are you familiar with Fat Bear Week, first of all?
I had heard of it, but never really explored it. It's something that had sat in my mind. And then you mentioned it before the show, and I did my digging in, and I was like, this is something that I definitely should have been very aware of the entire time.
So I'm actually very glad to hear you say that, because this morning I was just looking through my RSS feeds, and I don't remember if it was Hacker News or something. It was like, oh, it's Fat Bear Week. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cute. Fat Bear Week, where it's a national park, and they put up pictures of bears that are ready to hibernate, and they ask people to like vote on which one's the fattest bear. Then I saw that the BBC had it on their front page. Then the Economist podcast had it as one of their three segments that they do in their daily news show. And I was like, I don't know who the PR agency is behind Fat Bear Week, but they have really launched it into the public consciousness. So I'm actually kind of glad to hear, Amos, that you in Alaska were like, yeah, I sort of knew about it, but it's really not, you know, front and center, because it makes me think something's up. Like what big fat bear is.
I think this is something that maybe one of my daughter had brought home from school last year or something like that, you know, because that's kind of where it's aimed. It's aimed at it's an educational thing. It's run by three park rangers, you know, it was founded by a park ranger. It's pretty awesome that they found a way to make it go viral this year.
At least it's for a good cause. Well, not even a cause, but you know, like it's for educational purposes.
It's for education and awareness and things like that. That's the cornerstone of it. They're not like, it's not charging money for votes or anything else. So
awareness.
I'm really excited about it. I think it's pretty fascinating. I only know of one spot around here in Alaska that was within driving range of my house where I could go and view bears on a fairly consistent basis. And it's far enough in the backwoods that there'd be no way of getting away if you needed to. So I haven't done that. Like, it's really cool to see them until you can't get away from them and they see you. Like, that's where I'm at with it. But yeah, I fully support it. I think it's great. And some of these bears, the transition photos between what they look like in the spring and what they look like now in the fall.
Yeah.
Pretty dramatic.
Yeah,
especially
it's wild.
The cubs. Pretty crazy.
All right, let's pick a title for today's show. Folks in our Twitch chat and Discord have been submitting titles and voting on them over at showbot.tv/DTNS2. Our top vote getter for DTNS title is from Chaos ASL, Pixel, now with snore detection. There's also Pixels and Chips. I like that because it brings them both together. Mm. All Chips in for Chips. Google gives you the Dutch oven. I feel like I shouldn't say that out loud. We aren't funding the government properly from JPEG. That's not a title. That's just a statement.
That's just a fact.
Yeah. Just a truth.
You get a billion. You get a billion. KSASL.
It's hard to change platforms. Roger, what are we going with?
We went with chips or pixels and chips from Chaos ASL.
Nice, nice. Get them both in the title. I like that.
Now everyone's going to be hungry.
Now for the back half of the show, for the Good Day Internet part of the show, our top vote getters are how to start a podcast, even though we never actually gave the steps. who camps out for new tech? That was good.
Most of us.
Yeah. Podcasting by the seat of our pants. Old men get cranky about how podcasting used to be. That's pretty good, Dark Ammon. You don't know what it was like. Tech tailgating is good. Jen and burners from KSAs.
Burner.
For your disposable phones.
Disposable phones.
Oh yeah.
Your burner phone.
What tech podcasters queue for? Like that's a nice little wrap up there.
I feel like we have to go with old men get cranky about that podcast.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's so good.
It's too good.
Done.
All right. Thank you, everybody who submitted those titles and voted on them in our Twitch chat and our Discord. Also, thanks to everybody who supports us at patreon.com/DTNS. We got a really nice raise and note from Tony. He gave us a raise and then sent us a note to let us know that it was a cost of living raise and that we needed to use the new covers on our TPS reports. So thank you, Tony, for giving us a raise. Thank you also to Sam, who gave us a raise as well. We really, 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 really appreciate that. We have lots of folks supporting us on Twitch. Brand new follows from KazMike1966, Liz Aaron, Uhura42, Bad Gamer Dad, and Cornerstone EWW. Or Cornerstone WW. And we got some bits from Zoe Brings Bacon and Loki Robert. That's going to wrap it up for us. Jen, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I had a blast.
It was great having you. Thanks again, Rob. Good to see you.
Always pleasure to be here.
And until tomorrow, everyone, have a good day.
Have a good day.
Good day.